You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 91. I'm Jessica Yaquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about Rapa Nui. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dene Teh, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Friar Francisco Nahoy and Mata'u Rapu on the show, and the two of them are going to introduce themselves. So, Friar, can we start with you?
Yeah, so I'm Francisco Nahoy, and I live in California at the moment. Like Mata'u, whom you'll meet in just a moment, I belong to the Rapa Nui people of Easter Island.
Yoran Korua, my name is Mata'u Rapu. I am a documentary filmmaker, also from Rapa Nui, and I am currently based on Dakota land here in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Love it. Okay. So what got each of you into the type of work that you do today?
Well, I'm a Catholic priest, so I guess my primary identity, at least insofar as apostolic engagement is concerned, derives from being a Franciscan friar and a Catholic priest. But I, you know, have spent a lot of time over the last 40 years on the island, and I've often felt that I have sort of two lives that I live, one that's connected to the island and that one that's connected to the rest of the world. But just recently, the Council of Elders, we call them Te Mau Hatu, asked me if I would be their North American delegate for the recovery and repatriation of Rapa Nui ancestral remains that have found their way into U.S. or Canadian museums or departments of anthropology or private collections. And yeah, I thought this sounds like an appropriate thing for me to attempt to do. Of course, I'm learning on the job, but that's really what what brings me here tonight.
It's the best place to learn, I guess, right? Just do
yeah.
it. Do
I
it.
Agree.
You'll learn by doing.
Let's not fiddle around too much and just get to it.
Well, a lot of things pushed and pulled me into working in documentary film, but I think where it all came full circle for me as an indigenous Rapa Nui was when I realized that there is a problem with communication. There's a problem with the way in which our story as Rapa Nui is communicated to the rest of the world. In that, and Pancho, I know you've felt this too. Whenever I introduce myself, hi, I'm from Easter Island or Rapa Nui, people are confused because they think it's an isolated, desolate island and that nobody lives there. And when people eventually get on an airplane, if they're, you know, fortunate to come down and visit our island, they see that the image that is painted of Rapa Nui is very different than what the reality is of Rapa Nui, that we are a living, thriving culture, that we know who made our statues, the Moai, and what they're used for. And so when I realized that there's this communication issue, I realized that the work that I was doing as a filmmaker is really a potential answer to that. So I think I've dedicated a lot of my career now to focus on issues around indigenous cultures, my own, and also being allies to other filmmakers to tell their stories so that there is a more complete picture about indigenous communities and indigenous people out in mass media.
Yeah. So can both of you talk a little bit about the efforts that you have both done on those, both of those fronts. So on repatriation, and then, you know, like what kinds of films have you decided to take on, for example?
So first of all, it sounds on the face of it as if we're, you know, we've got two separate spheres of interest, and we're talking about two different aspects of Rapa Nui culture and the world building activities of the indigenous peoples. I don't think of it that way, though. One of the factors that led to the dispersal of Rapa Nui human remains into anthropological museums all over the world is the lack of any continuity between the experience that the islanders are having of themselves, on the one hand, and how visitors to the island, starting in 1722, when a Dutch fleet arrived there on Easter Sunday, how they experienced the island, right? And so there's a sense in which Mata'u's larger project, which is really a matter of giving a voice to the indigenous peoples of Rapa Nui, is intimately linked to recovery and repatriation efforts in this respect. Mm-hmm. These activities on the part, ostensibly on the part of Te Mauhatu, the Council of Elders, and Kodeipa, which is the development commission on the island, and the various agents that they have at work in different sectors of the world where we're likely to encounter Rapa Nui human remains. And let me tell you, they're all over the place, right? I mean, people have come from all over the world to Rapa Nui and taken human remains away as if they were prizes, right? So it's a challenge to try and figure out where these are and how we can convince people to give them back to us. But that's really a matter of finding our collective indigenous voice and asserting it in a matter that is really of critical interest, I would say, to every living Rapa Nui person, whether that person fully appreciates it or not. Our island is known everywhere in the world because of the world-building activities of our ancestors on what was at the time the most isolated place on the planet, most isolated place of human habitation on the planet. And, you know, partly it was the astonishment of non-Polynesian peoples who came to the island starting early in the 18th century and thereafter at what our ancestors had achieved that led to the current problem that we're trying to rectify now, namely the dispersal of our human remains. But I would say that we owe this effort to our ancestors who have given us so much. And we owe everything to them, really, partly because the culture that they built on the island was oriented toward the survival of islanders themselves and the transmission of survival techniques anchored especially in the principle of collective labor for great projects that made it possible for there to be modern descendants of the ancient Rapa Nui people who created the magnificent material culture for which the world knows the island. So we're, you know, these repatriation efforts are part of that larger framework of reference that is basically giving a voice to an indigenous community that hasn't been listened to, at least not on its own terms, really almost ever.
Yeah,
I totally agree. And I think my, you know, I'm fairly new to this work around repatriation, but it's not foreign to me. I have many members of my family who are scientists. My dad is an archaeologist who trained under Bill Malloy, who was one of the first archaeologists and, you know, ancestor to Father Francisco here, who worked on the island. And I also came across the work of repatriation in one of my first independent films, I would say. I produced a film called Eating Up Easter, which played on PBS here in the U.S. in 2020. But it largely centers around a woman by the name of Mama Pidu. She was an elder in the community. She did a lot of work around the issue of microplastics and plastics and trash management on the island. But prior to that, she did repatriation work. She lived for a very long time in France, cataloging artifacts that existed in different museums in Europe and in other places. And it was through being with her and filming with her that I really sort of started to understand that side of her story. And what's impactful to me, and this has happened to me several times in my life now, is that there are things that happen. There are unexplainable things that happen at particular times in my life that shoot me into a direction, which is what I believe is meant to be. So what happened in this film is that in 2018, I was finishing the film. It had taken me about 6 years to make. And we were about a month away of finishing. And then I get a message from a friend of mine on Rapa Nui, letting me know that Mama Pidu had passed away. And the island was in mourning. She was an incredibly powerful woman and leader on the island. And I had been with her in the edit, looking at her face for those 6 years, right? Whether I was actually with her, filming with her, or editing her words on my computer, it was very visceral, even though I was on the other side of the world. I was in Minnesota, right? And that was one of those impactful moments. Another more recent impactful moment is when Pancho called me, or we connected over the repatriation work that he had been doing. And another elder from Rapa Nui suggested that I connect with him over the repatriation work. And he tells me, he says, "Are you still living in Minneapolis?" I was like, "Yeah, why?" And Pancho, you clearly say it. It's just seared into my mind. And you said, "The University of Minnesota has bones from Ahuhekii." Like, there, here I am feeling like I am the only, I know I'm the only Rapa Nui, except for my kids, in Minnesota. I've lived here for about 14 years. And less than a mile from my house are bones of my ancestors, right? And so these are these just like moments in my life that keep pushing me, propelling me into different directions. So it was an incredible honor to be with Pancho and with Susana Nahoe, an archaeologist from Rapa Nui, and participate in taking possession of those bones from the University of Minnesota. But it really also just kind of set me on a track to realize that I, even though I live on the other side of the planet from my community, I have a very important position in where I am living here in the United States to be of service.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case, right? With regard to Mama Pidu, you know, this is a little bit of a convoluted story, but I'll start. In the period from roughly 1868, well into the 1950s, Rapa Nui was basically colonized by a series of private sheep herding franchises, starting with an Anglo-Tahitian operation called Maison Brandaire, and continuing with a Franco-Chilean franchise operated out of Valparaíso called the Compañía de Isla de Pascua, and culminating in a subsidiary of the Williamson Balfour Company, a Scottish sheep herding franchise called the CEVIP, the Compañía Explotadora Isla de Pascua. So, in fact, what had happened in 1888, Chile annexed Napa Nui and immediately turned the island over to one of these sheep herding franchises and gave them the authority, in effect, to administer the island. So this made the Williamson Balfour Company and its agents also the agency of Chilean colonialism on the island. Mm. Now, during this period, the director of the Williamson Balfour franchise on the island, a fellow by the name of Henry Percival Edmonds, put a bounty, in effect, on Rapa Nui crania and persuaded Rapa Nui people to bring them to him. And he handed them over to collectors, right and left. I'm working with a couple of institutions right now, so I don't want to identify them because I don't want to impede the progress that we're making. But in some cases, you know, these collectors made gifts of these Rapa Nui crania to North American and European museums. Hmm. So in the 1920s, one of these collectors received at least several crania, both for him to give away to others, or in some cases to sell to others, and for him to develop his own personal biological anthropology collection. So this was an Austro-Chilean filmmaker who had this private collection that eventually his heirs in the 1970s, this is during the dictatorship, alienated entirely. They sold the collection to a London broker who then distributed these Rapa Nui materials and probably, you know, the physical remains of other indigenous peoples of Chile as well, all over the world. Well, two of those Rapa Nui crania went to museums in New Zealand. Now, I'm still trying to find out who the London broker was because I want to find out what else he had and where else it went. Right.
Yeah.
But these materials that ended up in the two New Zealand museums, they were Te Papatongarewa and the Natural History Museum at the University of Canterbury, which I believe is on their South Island. You know, these just became part of those physical anthropology collections. But also in the 1970s, there is a growing Maori activist movement, largely modeling itself off the American Indian movement here in the United States. And these Maori, the Maori are the indigenous Polynesian peoples of Aotearoa, which is the endonym of what most of the rest of the world calls New Zealand, right? These Maori activists eventually were able to convince the government of New Zealand that it had a moral responsibility to repatriate the human remains that had been taken from the Maori Marae and from the Moriori peoples of the Chatham Islands. So the government of New Zealand, now you're still following me, right? We started on Rapa Nui, we went to Chile, from Chile to London, from London to New Zealand, all right? So the government of New Zealand in 2007 founded a governmental agency called Karanga Aotearoa, which is basically, you know, New Zealand repatriations. And they facilitated the repatriation of Moriori ancestral remains to the Chatham Islands and Maori ancestral remains to the various Marae. And when these repatriations had taken place, these same Maori activists said, okay, now you have to give back the Polynesian ancestral remains from the other islands. Mm-hmm. And they started with Rapa Nui. Hmm. And they did it by contacting Mama Piru. Hmm. because she had a profile both in, you know, material culture repatriation and in environmental activism. So in 2018, this would have been shortly before she died, she traveled with a group from Rapa Nui to New Zealand, and they took possession of these two crania and brought them back to the island through continental Chile. So the first repatriations, and the first international repatriations as well, took place then, thanks to Mama Piru's activist profile and, you know, her activities on behalf of I would call it building consciousness of indigenous rights and responsibilities. So that's really the beginning of the repatriation of Rapa Nui ancestral remains to the island. That was in 2018. Then in 2019, 2020, and 2021, the National Museum of Natural History in Chile repatriated all of the remains that they had in their custody, the majority of which had been handed over to them in 1955, 1956, by Thor Heyerdahl, who had led the Norwegian archaeological expedition to the island. Now, I want to make a distinction between the kind of activity undertaken by the Norwegian archaeological expedition in 1955 and things that happened previously, like, for example, what was going on in 1920. In the first place, Heyerdahl and all the senior researchers on that expedition signed repatriation agreements with the authorities and with the elders of the island. I had no clue that they had done this. I was shocked out of my gourd when I stumbled across a reference to it in correspondence that I was filing through, and actually found a copy of the repatriation agreement. What had happened, and you know, Matatlu's dad is also very aware of these issues. When you put sheep on an island that's never had sheep before, right? What do? They walk all over the ahu and the burial sites. They knock rocks loose. They pull up grass from the roots, which contributes to erosion, which then exposes the grave sites. So part of the reason that there were crania being just carried off by visitors to the island all the time is because they were exposed to view, largely because of the erosion, you know, that the sheep herding ventures generated. So there, the point that I'm trying to make here is simply this. There is a close relationship between environmental degradation, the endangerment of Rapa Nui traditional burial sites, and the repatriation efforts are being undertaken now. So in some cases, you know, the relationship is that environmental degradation leads to the taking away of ancestral remains. But the Mama Piru example also suggests that environmental activism, in a certain sense, goes hand in hand with the kind of indigenous self-assertion of dignity that is implicit in these recovery and repatriation efforts. So I just want to underscore how important Mama Piru is for us on a variety of different levels.
Yeah, she sounds like an incredible lady. I mean, I don't even know exactly what to say there, but
I sent you a link to the Amazon Prime video place where they park Matau's documentary on her. So the Eating Up Easter. So take a look at it. I mean, it's worth watching.
Yeah, no, I already had it like up and was just, when we finished, going to tell my husband that we have a new movie to watch. Very good. I went in the field with some elders from Comanche not too long ago, the Comanche Nation, and they were talking about that movie Prey that was on Hulu. They did a version all in Comanche.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I had to like go back and rewatch it afterwards before I saw them again the next time. So we could talk about it. But yeah. So now I'm like, okay, we have our next, our next video assignment. Yeah. It was awesome. I totally recommend watching it, by the way. But
yeah.
But this reflection on Mama Piru and her work just underscores for me the close relationship between the assertion of indigenous rights, environmental protection efforts, and in our case, the recovery of ancestral remains. Mm-hmm. You'd think that they would be separate spheres of activity. In fact, they're deeply integrated.
I never quite thought about it in that way, what you were talking about with the sheep. And yeah, that's a really interesting, I mean, obviously environmental protection plays into cultural heritage since, you know, culture is not just about the archaeology, it's about the land and the natural resources as well. But I thought that was a really interesting tie-in, how you're talking about how the environmental degradation also causes the cultural degradation and so on and so on.
We are already at our first break point, and we will jump right back in when we get back.
When Mama Piru passed in 2018, you know, we decided to dedicate the film to her. And one of the questions I get a lot from audiences after they watch the film is, so who's doing her work now? Who picked up what she was doing? And it's hard for me to answer that. Not because there aren't people doing that work. There are people doing that work. But I feel like there are individuals in her generation and in previous generations, and I include my dad in this too, is that, you know, when you look at elders, they are giants, you know? They have power, they have mana, they have all of this to be able to move communities, to get people to work, to, you know, yell at authorities, political authorities in the face, mm-hmm. You know, and they have that charisma in them, I think, that it's difficult to say how then subsequent generations then fill those shoes, right?
Right.
Me and Francisco, me and Pancho, we are that next generation. And it is our charge to fill those shoes. But when you look at who she was and the power that she is, it's hard to say, yeah, I can do what she did. At least for me, it is.
Right.
And so that it kind of leans into something that's deeper about, I think, the Rapa Nui culture too, which, you know, our moai, right, our statues, what in many ways it makes our island famous around the world. They are images of our ancestors, right? That we know that to be true. Our ancestors, we, Pancho and I, are descendants of the carvers of those statues. But so much of our culture is about ancestor worship, is about elder reverence to these individuals, these powerful people in the past. So in the documentary work, I see my work as that, as I'm creating these digital moai statues so that we can, you know, you can hop over to Amazon and live with Mama Piru just as she was alive, right? In a sense. But I think when I think about the work, this repatriation work of bringing our ancestor bones back to their place, I think of that as something that transcends just our generation, whether we understand that or not. It's something that's part of our culture, you know,
mm-hmm.
to have that reverence and that respect for these people who, for many different reasons, were taken away from their home. And so I guess that's kind of how I make the connection between the work that I do now as a documentary filmmaker and the work that I look forward to doing in more of this repatriation work, to be able to also not only to communicate the importance of the work to our own community and have that conversation, but I think also be able to communicate that out to the different institutions that have these items, whether they are ancestral bones, whether they are artifacts, unique artifacts. There's an element that we as Rapa Nui are not able to access fully of ourselves and our culture because these things are in locked closets or behind glass panes in museums and other research institutions. And I think that's where, when we talk about righting the ship, it's when Indigenous communities and these different institutions are on an equal playing field to talk about what is right and how can we make amends of maybe wrongs that were made in the past.
So one of the effects of saying, you know, for UNESCO to say Rapa Nui is a World Heritage Site, right? That means those Moai belong to the world, not to the Rapa Nui.
Right.
So this actually reinforces the British Museum's argument that there's no, you know, Hoʻohakamanaʻia is in a better place in London than in, you know, Oromo. Because, you know, that's what the ethos of extraction is all about. We are preserving this material for science. And science is higher than anything. Well, I mean, obviously, I'm a Catholic priest. I have certain opinions about what's highest. And it's, you know, as valuable as science is.
Yeah.
We do not fall on our knees and worship science. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the, I mean, I agree with Matalu. There really is no one person who is attempting to replace Mama Piru or who could, even if they were to attempt something so foolhardy. But I can say that I think, you know, today, if you go out to the archaeological sites, you'll see just regular Rapa Nui people, some of them even young Rapa Nui people, bending down to pick up garbage, stuff it in their pocket, and keep walking, right? Mm-hmm. I remember distinctly, maybe let's say 30-some-odd years ago, being at, we were at Hanganui, you know, before the restoration of Ahu Tongariki. And yeah, there was just a ton of plastic there, and I started picking it all up and tucking it away. And people actually made fun of me. Nobody making fun anymore. And that's because of the influence of Mama Piru. So I wouldn't say that there's any one person who's replacing her, but I see a lot of people now doing things that she did.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was a very funny person too. But I mean, I can't tell you how many times you'll hear people on the island say, especially when they have some reason to confront the sort of neo-colonialist attitudes that you'll find, you know, sort of tucked in all over the place. They'll say, you know what, just pick up your garbage and your flag and take it away now. And I mean, that was she it was famous for that. Right. And but it's an ethos that you now see everywhere. And I have to say that I don't think that that's not really a bad thing. Because people are starting to recognize that there is an Indigenous Rapa Nui identity that is worth preserving. The world is a richer place for the descendants of the ancient Matamua who carved those statues. Mm-hmm.
That just makes me sad that that's like a new revelation. You know what I mean?
Oh. Well, it's not a new revelation to the Rapa Nui. I mean, we kind of always felt that way about ourselves. But I would say that what is new is that the Rapa Nui are beginning to recognize that they have a voice in the world. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's really the centerpiece of Matau's work.
Right.
To amplify that voice.
Well, and I think to add to that, you know, as Rapa Nui just sort of assimilates more into the rest of the world in the sense that people have Netflix accounts and they're on Instagram and they're, you know, they're watching stuff from the other side of the world. Like, we also have the opportunity to leverage, to not be kind of smashed, I guess, by the rest of the world. Like, technology now and all of the other things, which can also be detrimental to a lot of our cultural practices, right? And community building mm-hmm. and all of that mm-hmm. also helps to serve and give us a voice to the rest of the world so that right. people finally see us, right? People no longer say to me, well, most people still say, oh, I didn't realize people lived on Easter Island. But now there is less of those people. Yeah. You know, and yeah. and I would say the same for a lot of other Pacific Island communities, mm-hmm. isolated communities, even other indigenous groups, right? That right. they just jump in and they start creating and they start, you know, making new clothing lines that appear mm-hmm. in New York, and photographers and fashion models. I don't know. I can only think about Instagram right now, but I think that has power, that mm-hmm. that really has power to kind of like get our identity out to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And what we find so often in documentary work in particular, but just really sort of any sort of nonfiction work, is the possibility to build empathy around individuals through these storytelling mediums. Right. So a lot of the work that we do as documentary filmmakers is try and find an emotional narrative arc in the story in order to engage an audience. And it doesn't matter if that audience has ever been to Rapa Nui or New Zealand or Hawaii or whatever. But the fact that we're humans and we can see another human being and empathize with them is critical, I think, not only for the storytelling aspect, but for all of these things that we're talking about, right? So that then when me and Pancho are knocking on doors saying, hey, we would like to have access to you know, the belongings of our ancestors, like they see us as people and they see our ancestors also as people. I think this question, I'm always sort of on the fence, Patrick. I want to talk to you a little bit more about this, about, you know, this element of like, I mean, Hoahaka Nanaia is largely debated, I would say, by a lot of Rapa Nui on whether it should stay in the British Museum or it should come home. And I don't have a position on where it should be. But my position is wherever it is, the Rapa Nui should have access to it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because it mm-hmm. because I remember meeting so many talented carvers on Rapa Nui when I was younger who had never seen these artifacts. They had only seen them in picture books by Thor Heyerdahl, by other people. Yeah. And they were trying to replicate. Yeah. They're trying to replicate something that their ancestors made from a photograph because they don't have access to the actual object. And that is incredibly sad.
And by and large, doing a darn good job of it, too. I mean, those artisans are fantastic. I mean, they're really, really good.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that there are actually works of contemporary Rapa Nui artisans in the British Museum now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, you could, I mean, they have a public access catalog. Hmm. So just go to the public access catalog and, yeah, just start searching for works under Rapa Nui Easter Island and the names of artisans whom you know, right?
Oh, awesome.
Bene Tukipate, for example, and so forth. And so it's ironic that there would be, you know, these modern pieces that were largely given to the British Museum by persons who had visited the island and had either been given these things from the artisans or had purchased them from the artisans, right? Mm. So on the one hand, there are those materials in the British Museum. On the other hand, there's Ho'ahaka Nanaia, which just happened to be the only moai that the HMS Topaz could plausibly carry off that wouldn't sink the ship. Right, because most of the moai obviously are too big to carry away. Thank goodness.
That's probably the only reason they're still there, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, a good number of the moai on Rapa Nui are larger than the sarsens of Salisbury Plain at Stonehenge, just to put them in perspective, right? So you couldn't imagine carrying one of those big stones. Well, now we discovered that they carried the one from Scotland all the way down to the Salisbury Plain, but you know it'd be a multi-generational project,
right?
And that's roughly the size of the moai, but there are more than 1,000 of them all over the island, and mm-hmm. our ancestors moved them to every point of the island that they are, because they're all carved in one location, and have been moved from that location to the places that they are now located. So it's phenomenal engineering, in addition to their artistic abilities. And I get it that, you know, World Cultural Patrimony wants to have access to it. I don't think any Rapa Nui are saying that people shouldn't have access to it.
Right.
But the argument of the British Museum, you know, not just with regard to Ho'ahaka Nanaia, but, you know, the Elgin marbles and anything else, right, is that they are better preserved in London than they would be anywhere else in the world.
Right. Right.
But, you know, then we discovered, what was it, just last summer? I mean, it's barely 13, 14 months that British Museum official, turns out he'd been pilfering materials from the British Museum and selling them on eBay for 15, 20 years.
Oh, my God.
Whoa.
Right. So much for the safer here in London theory. All right, I realize they're not gonna sell Ho'ahaka Nanaia on eBay, but I'm not sure that London really is the right place to preserve Ho'ahaka Nanaia. So anyway, I do agree that Rapa Nui has its own work to do in order to be ready to take possession of Ho'ahaka Nanaia. But I kind of feel like that's exactly the sort of work that we need to be doing. We need to be preparing ourselves for taking full responsibility of our cultural patrimony. Mm. And I have to say, too, that I'm very hopeful. You know, I see a lot of indications that we're moving. Maybe we're taking one step forward and two steps backwards sometimes. But other times, you know, we're taking two steps forward. And what can I say? Indigenous autonomy is never easy. It's just as fraught with difficulty as any kind of civic engagement and autonomy is anywhere. But, you know, these are skills that you have to learn. And so we, as struggle as we might with the demands of democratic decision-making, I think we're still moving in the right direction when we challenge ourselves to do these things.
Okay, so it's time for our second break. And again, we're just going to jump right back in when we get back. One thing I did want to ask you guys, I mean, I kind of what you were starting to get to right there at the end, is where do both of you want to go with all of this? Is there like an end goal that you have in mind? Is there a next film that you're itching to create? Yeah, what's next?
Ooh. Well, I'll go first. I mean, I would say early into the learning process of what is out there in terms of repatriation, mm-hmm. what is out there and the work that needs to be done. So along with that, there's this film that I've been really interested in doing, which is somewhat connected, which really has to do with the time in Rapa Nui where I say a lot of the mysteries, this idea of the mystery of Easter Island came about. And it really has to do with in the 1800s, slave ships from Peru coming out to the Pacific and taking slaves from the Pacific Islands and bringing them back to Peru. And one of those islands that they stopped at was our island. And they took a lot of our population. Pancho, I don't know if you recall the number, but I've heard around at least 2,000 people, maybe about half of the population.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And And many of those people were elders. There were older individuals who held those stories, right? That oral history, mm-hmm. we're an oral history culture, right? So we pass down our information from generation to generation. And if you all of a sudden break that chain through the slave raids, a lot of that information about oral history is lost. And so now a lot of the work that's being done, I would say through science and archaeology and all of that, is to try and piece back together the oral history that we understand or that we still have with what science tells us that is there, right? And in that way, we can kind of sort of build back a little bit of history. Mm-hmm. In our community. But to me, that critical point of the slave raids was disastrous to our island. And that's something I think that there's opportunity to examine more. And I'm really interested in, because what it means is that 2,000 of our ancestors most likely died somewhere in Peru and are buried there. Right. So mm-hmm. talk about like the repatriation work that's happening in North America. There's also a lot that needs to happen and continue to happen in South America and in other parts of the globe. So I'm just sort of really thankful and energized by the work that Pancho and Susana Nahoy and all these other people are doing in trying to sort of take ownership and take back those pieces of us, you know, that were lost.
Mm, yeah, that's fascinating.
These slave raids that really devastated the island that Mata'u was speaking about began in 1862, in October of 1862. The practice in the Pacific is called blackbirding, and it began actually with Australians and raids into the islands that we would call today Melanesian islands and Western Polynesia, like Samoa, Tonga, Futuna, Wallis, and so forth. But it's important to remember that blackbirding takes place in a global context, right? By this time, British abolitionists had basically shut down the transatlantic slave trade. The United States is engaged in a devastating civil war provoked primarily by the issue of slavery. Chinese coolie labor is shut down in the Pacific. I mean, there are 3 U.S. Chinese exclusionary acts in the aftermath of the Civil War. But even before that, the United States is sending naval vessels into Chinese harbors to stop the outflow of Chinese labor into the Americas. Well, of course, all of that impacts Peru and Chile. And so, you know, taking a page out of the Australian book, they go blackbirding themselves, this time Eastern Polynesia, the Marquesas Islands, the Tuamotu Islands, which are 2 of the 5 archipelagos of French Polynesia. And Rapa Nui. Rapa Nui was the staging area. So just in the latter months of 1862, we have Chilean and Peruvian ships coming to the island, taking, you know, 150 here, 200 there. And in the arc of, I think it's like less than 2 years, like Mata'u says, close to 2,000 men and women are taken from the island. including our Ariki, the class who had the knowledge of the ancient Rapa Nui writing system called Rongorongo, and who were responsible for the cultural transmission of our ancient identity to subsequent generations. And it's really because of this devastation that happens in the 1860s that the island is completely vulnerable to a maniac Frenchman who seized power on the island in 1868 and ruled despotically until he was assassinated by islanders. And when this figure, his name was Dutroux-Bornier, when he died, you know, then the Maison Brandaire sent another agent to the island. And this was the environment in which, for example, the USS Mohican visited the island in 1886 and, you know, took away crania, including six of which I was, by the grace of God, able to recover this summer and hope to bring back to the island in a few months. So there is a considerable amount of international disruption that's going on all over the world that augments the vulnerability of the island. But there's no question that the primary vulnerability comes not from an island population passively accepting, you know, colonization, private colonization by sheep herding ventures, but from an island community devastated first by slave raids. And then, you know, it's interesting that the international authorities that intervened on behalf of the Rapa Nui were the Archbishop, the Catholic Archbishop of Papeete in Tahiti, Tepano Jossin. Tepanos is Polynesian name, but Etienne, Stephen is the name. And King Kamehameha IV. These are the international figures who intervened with the Peruvians, and the Peruvians didn't listen to them, but they also convinced the French to intervene. And, you know, France had just sent Maximilian and Carlota to Mexico, right? So I can almost imagine the French diplomat saying, we could do this in Peru, too, if you want. And whatever happened, it did convince the Peruvians to repatriate the survivors. Of the 2,000 who were carried off the island, only 15 returned. And they were infected with smallpox.
Ooh.
Which devastated the remaining 2,000 on the island.
Mm.
So that by 1877, the population of the island was 111 people. Every living Rapa Nui, including Mata'uanae, are descended from those 111. So it's not like the Rapa Nui just rolled over and played dead and let people carry their ancestral remains away or let them carry away Ho'aka Nama'ia.
Right.
They were very nearly extinguished.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in this period. You know, I mean, even my dad was born in, let me think, 1940. When my father was born, there were only 500 islanders.
Wow.
Today, we are, what, close to 6,000 Mata'u?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to say that the Rapa Nui story, from the beginning, I mean, from the very moment that Hotu Matua sent the advance guard, you know, the seven young voyagers, to plant taro and kumara to prepare for the immigration, the island has been characterized by survival under the most acute conditions of environmental precarity imaginable. And, you know, that continued when environmental precarity morphed into the vulnerability of islanders to visitors with guns. And, you know, the really culminating in the slave raids that Mata'u began talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also the beginning of the expatriation of our ancestral remains. So we, you know, Mata'u and I can't do anything about the Rapa Nui who died in Peru, or the Rapa Nui who died from smallpox, when the 15 survivors were brought back. By bending our efforts toward the repatriation of the ancestral remains of our ancestors, we are in a certain sense declaring that whatever may have happened to them, they still have intrinsic value. That is the duty of the living to the dead. And that's basically why we're involved in these activities.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And thank you, obviously, for that work that you do on behalf of your, you know, your people and the land and your ancestors. With all of that in mind, like, if there's one thing that you wish, like, the public knew about Rapa Nui, like, what would be the one, like, piece that you would want to leave people with?
I'd say we're still here. And we're as ornery as ever.
Yeah,
that's great.
I mean, Rapa Nui people, Mata, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I just feel like Rapa Nui people are so brilliantly, humorously, marvelously full of themselves that you'd never know that this was you'd think they were the descendants of Alexander the Great or something, right? That they'd conquered the whole world. We didn't conquer the whole world. We just survived in the most precarious place that the globe had to offer the world at the time.
Yeah.
That's our real claim to fame. Not even the Moai, as magnificent as they are.
Yeah, but survival and resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have, you know, you'll pardon the Rapa Nui for being so full of themselves. Under the circumstances, it served us well when it was the only thing between us and complete extinction. That belief that, no, we can do this.
And that there's value in our way continuing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I still see that in Rapa Nui people. It's the thing that probably impresses me the most about them. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Matau doesn't. Yeah.
No, I completely agree. Even I think about eating up Easter, the issue of microplastics and trash, it exists throughout Polynesia, right? Like, but what made
the world,
throughout the world, right? But when you put a moai on a poster surrounded by plastic, it like alerts people.
Yeah, that image is, I mean, I looked it up while we were talking and I definitely had a reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. So it's like that visceral reaction of, oh no, something really important is being damaged.
Yeah.
Something amazing and unique is going to go away. Right. And so I think the work is to really apply that same feeling, that same sentiment to Rapa Nui artifacts, to Rapa Nui the remains. I think that there's a lot of really powerful things that we can use, that we can do. And now I'm going off a train. I'm sorry. My train of thought is kind of windling a little bit. But yeah, I completely agree with you, Pancho. I think, you know, I'm really proud of being Rapa Nui because of what our ancestors were able to overcome and achieve and do all of this stuff. You know, my dad would often ask, or sort of like put this query out of like, what can we do today that is of massive scale and importance that the Moai were for our ancestors? Like, how do we match that?
Wow.
Yeah. You know, I don't know what that is. Because even a skyscraper, I mean, like building skyscrapers seem to be like really easy because they go up all the time, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that there's that thinking back. And I think, Pancho, when you talk about that survival and resilience, I think that that's also important for us Rapa Nui not living in Rapa Nui and finding our way out in the rest of the world, you know, and holding on to sort of that understanding of identity and culture wherever you are. Because there's a lot of us that don't live on Rapa Nui. Like, you know, these two people that are talking to you now, right? But our connection is always there. And for future generations, they will also be. So,
well, that is a beautiful place to end on. So I just want to say thank you to both of you for not only coming on the podcast and sharing your time and your thoughts and your experiences with everyone listening, but, you know, like the heart of your story. Your people's story and survival and talking about things that are not always easy to talk about. So I appreciate all of that. I appreciate you guys. And I'm very excited to go watch this movie. So everybody check out the show notes and look up Eating Up Easter. We'll have a link to it. So thank you again.
Right on.
Alrighty.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.